One symposium speaker has pointed out that the Afghan war is about to be the longest in U.S. history, exceeding Vietnam. Another said the current U.S. predicament in that country eerily parallels that of the Soviet Union 2 decades ago. Larry Goodson, the U.S. Army War College professor and former CENTCOM fellow who made the Soviet comparison, said that he is not sure how the U.S. can keep history from repeating itself. Scaling back its goals, he said, may be a start.
To settle for less, to not say we're going to fix Afghanistan, but to say we're going to do some fairly limited goals, and as soon as we achieve those goals, or we think we achieve those goals, we begin to disengage ourselves from Afghanistan.
Last year, President Barack Obama announced a 30,000-troop surge that will occur in Afghanistan this summer and a drawdown that is planned for the following year. Ronald Newman, the former U.S. ambassador to Kabul, called the latter wishful thinking. Goodson said that there's no real way to gauge victory in Afghanistan.
The president has said, you know, I put it on the slide yesterday, we're there to basically defeat al-Qaeda, which has largely moved next door into Pakistan and more globally. In Afghanistan, we also, as we heard today, we have all these problems of poverty and, you know, violence towards women and just a whole host of things that the U.S. could sort of lead in the improvement of would make for a better Afghanistan, a more stable region, and a better world. But is it really something the U.S., you know, should expend blood and treasure on? I don't know.
An anthropology professor at Boston University, Thomas Barfield, says that prepackaged government does not work, especially in a place as complex as Afghanistan.
In making policy, it is wise to determine which level is operational. Too much attention to tribal and ethnic differences at the national level can be misleading, but not understanding how these groups operate at the local level and appreciating the regional differences among them can be fatal.
Barfield says that ethnicity in Afghanistan consists of a complex interplay between local and national identity. The Taliban, which came to power after the Soviet withdrawal and the ensuing civil war, consists mainly of Pashtuns, the country's ethnic majority. He cited Mullah Omar's Taliban leadership as an example of an ethnic faction's use of religion to establish dominance.
One of the ways to unite relatively fractious tribes is to have a leader who is not tribal at all, but claims that he has the right by God to rule, and therefore there's no honor to be lost following a religious leader as opposed to following a cousin that you can't stand. And Mullah Omar falls into this category, and why he would push the religious identity and not the Pashtun identity is precisely because this takes leadership out of the tribal context.
Nazif Sharani, an anthropology professor at Indiana University, touched on an Afghan minority population that has faced intense prejudice for centuries, including diaspora and enslavement. They are the Hazara, a mostly Shia group from mountainous central Afghanistan. Their region once housed the towering 6th-century Buddha statues that the Taliban destroyed in 2001.
They look different compared to most other Afghans, that they're phenotypically Asiatic or racially Mongoloid, and as such subjected to serious racism.
The Hazara became a Taliban target after the Soviets withdrew from Afghanistan. Thousands of them were massacred after Hazarajat fell to the Taliban in 1998. Sharani said that all of Afghanistan's ethnic groups share a common thread.
They reflect the experiences of much of the rest of Afghanistan's population, not just the minorities, also the ordinary Pashtun. And that narrative is one that is tied to the history of failed state building.
Since the Taliban fell in 2001, Hazara oppression has reportedly subsided. But Sharani said that the situation is still not ideal, as evidenced by the fact that Hazarajat sees little of the international aid given to Afghanistan's centralized government.
In some ways, Hazaras are disillusioned, disappointed with the current situation, and very much upset by their own leaders in the way they have behaved, which is, again, falling into exactly the same mold as all ethnic groups in Afghanistan have practiced, including the ruling tribal clan, the Pashtuns, as such.
It is rare that a discussion of human rights in that country does not include women. Before beginning her talk on the state of women in Afghanistan, Hayat Alvi told the audience that they should be angry by her conclusion. She first listed the good, including efforts by the U.S., UN, and several non-government organizations, among others, to help women.
The creation of legal aid referral centers for women provides much needed legal services and assistance for women. The Afghan Ministry of Women's Affairs, Public Health, Education, and the Afghan Independent Human Rights Commission. These all work pretty proactively for women's issues.
But she said that disenfranchisement, poor literacy rates, and outright violence targeting women overshadow what's been achieved. She said education and health are strong indicators of the status of women. In Afghanistan, women's life expectancy rates dropped from 44 years to 43.2 years between 2002 and 2006. Inadequate perinatal care, she said, may be partly culprit.
Encompassed in this are the maternal mortality rates. Nearly 1,700, that's 1,700 deaths per 100,000 live births in 2009. This is the highest in the world, second highest in the world, second only to Sierra Leone.
Alvi added that the Afghan criminal justice system has a backwards attitude towards sexual violence against women.
Rape is not a crime according to the Afghan penal law or penal code. The elimination of violence against women law that was recently passed will finally criminalize rape. Warlords are known for gang rape. Perpetrators often go free. Rape victims often get thrown into prison because rape is defined in the context of the Islamic law concept of zina, or adultery.
One audience member asked what the source of such long-standing misogyny could be. Alvi said that, though this may be a complex issue, insecurity is at its core.
It really does go down to come down to attitudes. And fears and insecurity on the part of those men who are so brutal against girls and women, fear and insecurity in the sense and using culture and religion and other ideologies as a cover, basically, in my view, that if you empower women and girls, they will take advantage of the advantages that exist for men in areas of economics, politics, and perhaps other areas, and particularly decision-making.
The symposium will continue through Friday when General David Petraeus will give a keynote speech. Reporting from Tampa, for WMNF News, I'm Kate Bradshaw.